From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, a deep look at a so-called crisis.
There is a surge that's been developing in the number of unaccompanied children crossing the border from Mexico into the U.S.
And why Central American children have been fleeing their countries.
109 have been directly threatened to either join the gang or be killed, and 14 have had at least one of their family members murdered by the gangs.
And how they're getting here.
We were traded in downtown L.A. with our parents. The coyotes gave us to our parents, and our parents gave the money.
Plus, a look back at U.S. involvement in Central America's civil wars as we answer the question, how did this happen? All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Queda poco tiempo para redactar esta nota y dejar por escrito todo lo que no me hace sentido. A ver si le atino. Son tantas las frases que llegan de momento y me abrumo en silencio, por eso he decidido tomar un respiro. A ver si le atino.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. We start our show this week with the story of Moses. Not the biblical journey through the desert Moses, but a 14-year-old boy in New York State who embarked on a journey of his own to be with his parents. He came to this country in 2008 when he was just 8 years old. Moses' parents allowed us to interview him under the condition that we don't use his last name. His father said he was afraid that using his full name would come back to haunt him when he becomes an adult.
I came from Honduras. I don't remember much about Honduras. My dad came here like when I was 2, and my mom came when I was 4. They brought my 2 older brothers first, and then they wanted to bring me with my oldest brother. But then my oldest brother didn't want to come, and I decided to come, so they brought me by myself. I was 8. This man went to pick me up at my grandma's house in this car. Then we left from there. We went to a hotel to stay there for the night. And then the next day, they left me with, I think it was the coyote. We just walked, we were eating like food from the cans, and we were drinking dirty water. Yeah, so we decided to rest for a little bit, and then we saw migration, so then we started running, but they got me. Then they took me to this place, it was like prison or something like that, and then they took me to home care. Mm-hmm. They were actually treating us really nice. We were going to school, and they also took us to the park sometimes. We also went like to restaurants or bowling, places like that. My dad, I didn't know him well when I saw him the first time when I came here. I didn't know him well, and my mom either. Once I came here, I saw my dad in the airport when I got here, and I didn't know him well. They just I was with my bags, and they just took my bags, and then my dad just sat next to me and hugged me, and I kind of recognized him. I was really excited, and plus I was with my brothers. I was hugging them, and but the little one, because there was one that was born here, he was scared of me. He didn't know me. He was scared of me.
Is he still scared of you?
No. Well, in a way, yeah, because sometimes he gets me mad.
Every day since September of last year, an average of 180 children just like Moses, are apprehended by U.S. Customs and Border Protection agents at the U.S.-Mexico border. That number is really high. In the last year, the number of child migrants apprehended at the border nearly doubled from 35,000 in 2013 to roughly 66,000 as of August of this year. Now, the total number of apprehensions at the border, children or otherwise, remains at what the CBP calls historic lows. But this recent rapid increase in the number of unaccompanied children entering the United States presents huge challenges. But these numbers have been growing for over a decade. So why label this a crisis? Not long ago, the majority of child migrants entering the U.S. were from Mexico. But now Mexicans account for only about a fourth of child migrants. Today, nearly three-quarters are from Central America, the vast majority from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. And so, our nation's ongoing and difficult conversation about immigration continues to shift. Chances are, you might have heard about this.
Immigration crisis is unfolding this morning along the southern border. Officials in Arizona are scrambling to help.
The truth is, this is nothing new. It's not the first time children have migrated here alone, nor is it the first time we've experienced a wave of migration from Central America. In fact, a largely unreported side of this story is the role the United States has played in what the media is calling the child migrant crisis. So let's look at the historical roots. Throughout the 1980s, much of Central America was experiencing violence and war. In El Salvador, a group of guerrilla factions known as the Farabundo Martí Liberation Front, or the FMLN, fought against a military government in a civil war that lasted over 12 years. The conflict displaced hundreds of thousands of Salvadorans and claimed more than 80,000 lives. In Guatemala, a civil war between leftist groups and the militarized Guatemalan government lasted for 36 years. Nearly 200,000 people were killed or went missing. To the south, Nicaragua saw right-wing rebel groups known as the Contras fighting against the socialist Sandinista government for control of the region. And internationally, these conflicts were relevant to the broader Cold War, which most people hardly even talk about anymore. Guerrilla groups in both El Salvador and Guatemala had leftist ideologies and got support from Cuba and the Soviet Union. The U.S. feared these Central American countries would fall under the influence of communism as part of the domino theory. So the U.S. intervened.
A number of times in past years, members of Congress and a president have come together in meetings like this to resolve a crisis. I have asked for this meeting in the hope that we can prevent one.
Under President Ronald Reagan, the U.S. pumped millions into the Salvadoran and Guatemalan governments and their militaries.
Too many have thought of Central America as just that place way down below Mexico that can't possibly constitute a threat to our well-being.
U.S. taxpayers paid for military aid and training camps for troops, many of which were located in Honduras. At that time, Honduras was not going through a war, but the U.S. used it as a kind of home base for its military activity in the region. Over time, many refugees fled from Guatemala and El Salvador to find asylum in the U.S.
The reason why people came to the United States during the 1980s in particular was because of the wide destabilization that the United States was very intimately involved with.
That's Cesar Cuauhtémoc García Hernández, professor at the University of Denver who studies the intersections of criminal and immigration law.
Political destabilization and economic strife are not problems that are resolved from one day to another.
But García Hernández doesn't believe those are the only consequences we're living with. At home, the U.S. was fighting what it called the war on drugs.
Drugs are menacing our society. They're threatening our values and undercutting our institutions. They're killing our children.
In the 1980s, we start to see that South American cocaine begins to move north through Central America and Mexico. There was a perception, in large part by the Reagan administration, that drug activity that was affecting urban areas throughout the country was really being brought here by migrants.
Our country then began to imprison and deport these migrants believed to be fueling the drug war. Migrants who had fled the very violence that the U.S. had helped to create.
Historically, the United States did not deport too many people because of involvement in drug activity. What changed in the 1980s was that we criminalized a lot more drug activity and then tacked onto that immigration consequences for people who are not United States citizens. For example, now it's true that a conviction for almost any drug offense will result in deportation. And historically, that was not true.
But recently, things have changed for how child migrants are treated. Deportations don't apply to children the same way they do to adults. That's thanks to a 2008 law passed under the Bush administration called the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, or the TVPRA for short. The law is an attempt to combat child trafficking, and it mandates that every child migrant who is neither Mexican nor Canadian be screened in order to make sure that they're not victims of human trafficking. TVPRA does not grant children asylum, nor does it give them protected status, but it does give them time. So why are these kids leaving home in the first place? There's been a lot of narratives tossed around about the reasons, but thanks to Elizabeth Kennedy, we have a pretty good idea, at least for kids coming from El Salvador. Kennedy is a Fulbright scholar currently living in the country's capital, San Salvador. She's been doing interviews with hundreds of children across El Salvador, some who have left the country only to be deported back, others who are planning on leaving soon.
At this point, I've done just over 600 interviews.
Kennedy is trying to figure out exactly what is driving these kids to emigrate from their countries and what's pulling them towards the U.S.
We start off by asking basic demographic data. So we ask their name, their age, who they live with, if they attend a church, what living in their neighborhood is like. So if there is a presence of gangs, police, military. For those who say there is a gang presence, we ask how often they hear gunshots.
She asks an extensive list of questions about work, home life, and the hopes and dreams of these kids.
10 to 15 minutes into the interview, we explicitly ask them why they would like to leave the country. They tell us that they are afraid of gangs. We'll ask them if they've ever been threatened, if anyone they know has ever been threatened. If they respond yes, we'll ask when the threats started, what the threats were, with what frequency they occurred.
Needless to say, she's collected an incredible amount of data on these children. She says that gang violence is listed as the main reason why they're leaving El Salvador.
The next most common reason that's listed is family reunification. 35% give this as a reason for their migration. That's an interesting number because over 90% have a family member in the United States. Over half have at least one parent in the United States.
Ultimately, Kennedy says it's important to know why the kids are coming because it affects the way the story is framed.
For me, this is a refugee crisis. This is not about economic immigration. This is not about family reunification. Yes, those components are there, but the family reunification piece has always been there. The economic piece has always been there. And I do think we need to address those things. But more than anything, these are desperate people living in desperate times. And so the United States and the other countries involved, Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, need to be thinking about how can we provide protection in the short term for those who need it, and how can we work in the long term towards ameliorating the impacts of violence and security and rebuilding the social contract to make sure that these kids get a shot to transition and become the people they want to be.
Coming up next on Latino USA, the story of MS-13, the street gang from Los Angeles that's terrorizing parts of Central America.
To all of a sudden, you know, just put on a tattoo and be empowered and feared the level of this. The level these kids were fear was too empowering.
Stay with us. No se vayan.
Pelo velho mundo.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, we're looking at the root causes for the uptick in children migrating to the U.S. from Central America, and how this decades-long issue suddenly became framed as a crisis. Now, there is no one cause that speaks to every child situation, but we do know the most common reason they're coming.
The most common reason that is given is a fear of gangs, violence, and insecurity. That's listed by 60%.
That's Elizabeth Kennedy, the researcher we heard from earlier. She's been interviewing kids in El Salvador about why they're leaving. The answer is gangs.
As far as what that looks like in their daily lives, 145 of 322 live in a neighborhood with a gang present. Then 109 have been directly threatened to either join the gang or be killed, and 14 have had at least one of their family members murdered by the gangs. Finally, there are 32 of these children who are so afraid that they never leave their homes at day or night.
The gangs that keep these children trapped in their houses are the Mara Salvatrucha, also known as MS-13, and their rivals, the 18th Street Gang. The violence generated by their fighting has become one of the biggest challenges facing El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras today. Our producer, Marlon Bishop, picks up the story.
If you've heard anything about the Mara Salvatrucha, it probably went something like this.
It's the most violent gang in America. It has 10,000 foot soldiers in the U.S., spreading its brutal ways across 33 states.
The crimes were the handiwork of one of the deadliest gangs in the world, Mara Salvatrucha, known as MS-13.
MS is spreading fast, like a virus, and mutating into an international menace.
These clips from TV documentaries may be sensationalist, but you get the gist. Mara Salvatrucha, better known as MS-13, has earned a reputation as one of the most violent gangs anywhere, with possibly up to 100,000 members in the U.S., Mexico, and Central America. But long before MS-13 was an international super gang, it began as a group of young immigrants in Los Angeles, California, made up of guys like Alex.
My name is Alex Sanchez. I'm an immigrant from El Salvador. I came here as a child in 1979, just before the war started. I got in trouble with my issues of the clash of culture I was confronted with, and I ultimately joined a gang.
That gang was MS-13. Alex has since left and now leads a nonprofit called Homies Unidos, which means Homies United. They help rehabilitate former gang members. Few people managed to get out of MS-13 as Alex did, but the way he got in is typical. His parents immigrated to the U.S. in the mid-70s. They left Alex and his little brother with relatives in El Salvador when they were very young. A smuggler was hired later to bring the kids to California. Alex was 7 years old and only knew his mother from a black and white photo he carried with him on the journey.
We were traded in downtown L.A. with our parents. The Coyotes gave us to our parents, and our parents gave the money. So we're sitting in the truck with my brother and looking at these two complete strangers that now we had to call mom and dad. So it was really difficult. The transition of you know, that the separation of my parents was really difficult to kind of mend. And in some ways, we never did.
Alex's family lived near the Pico Union neighborhood, where most Salvadoran immigrants in the city settled. They struggled to adapt to their new lives.
The most difficult thing was transitioning into the mainstream culture, which was predominantly Mexican or Chicano, and we suffered a lot of persecution because of our differences in the way we spoke Spanish, the fact that we were immigrants from Central America, and we suffered a lot of bullying in school, in the community.
Soon, Alex started spending time with a group of Salvadoran kids that weren't ashamed to be from Central America, kids who stood up to the bullying. They were members of MS-13, a new gang formed in imitation of the Mexican and African-American gang that had long been a fixture in L.A.
It didn't take too long for me to actually really start liking the fact that this group provided some of my needs that I had, you know, the sense of belonging, the sense of protection, the sense of of being taken into account.
Alex was jumped into the gang at age 14 and soon left home to live with members of his new so-called family. He started drinking, doing drugs, and eventually committing crimes.
You know, eventually you get arrested for one of those things, either stealing or assaults and whatnot. And I ended up getting arrested for assaults, and I ended up in juvenile hall.
Time spent at juvenile hall only hardened Alex's instincts and led him on the path to prison. Then, in 1994, Alex was deported back to El Salvador. He wasn't alone. In the early 90s, the LAPD began collaborating with the Immigration and Naturalization Service to deport immigrants convicted of aggravated felonies. A 1996 federal law made it even easier for judges to deport gang members. This law especially affected MS-13, since so many members were undocumented. Between 2000 and 2004 alone, an estimated 20,000 Central American criminals were deported back to their home countries. Here's law professor Cesar Cuauhtemoc Garcia Hernandez, who follows the issue.
Once back in Central American countries that were only barely beginning to move beyond civil war, there was almost no ability for those countries to absorb these young people back into their society in any productive fashion. And so eventually those gangs became much larger, much more powerful.
Alex Sanchez says he had hoped that going back to El Salvador would be a fresh start, a chance to leave the gang life.
But all of that went out the window as soon as I got out of the airport. As I was going towards the terminal, I saw a boulder out of a hillside with the letters of the MS-13. As we kept on that road, there was a big wall, and it had the Roman numerals XV111. And that's when I realized that the rivals were there too.
XV111 was the symbol for the 18th Street Gang, MS-13's sworn enemy from Los Angeles. Through the mass deportations, both gangs gained a presence in Central America. Their turf wars came with them. By the early 2000s in El Salvador, the growing gang menace became a hot political issue. The government started a get tough on crime policy called the mano dura, or tough hand.
The effects of these policies have been very, very, very bad.
Jose Miguel Cruz is an expert on Salvadoran gangs at Florida International University. He says the basic principle of mano dura was to get gang members off the street and into prisons. It was inspired by the zero-tolerance policing model that was used in New York, but taken further. The government passed an anti-gang law that allowed police to arrest people who simply appeared to belong to a gang, whether or not they committed a crime based on tattoos or style of dress.
They just locked them up and left them there. Being there 24/7, without any supervision, without any program inside the prisons, gang members basically have all the time to organize, to generate some sort of structures and leadership that allow them to grow as a criminal organization, something that they weren't at the beginning.
The plan backfired. Swollen with criminals, the prisons became finishing schools for gang members. Jose says that if the U.S. policy of deportation gave gangs a toehold in Central America, mano dura made them thrive. Just look at the numbers.
Before the mano dura, gangs were responsible more or less of 7% of all homicides in El Salvador. After the mano dura, gangs were responsible almost 45% of homicides in El Salvador.
Meanwhile, the government gave tacit approval to armed vigilante groups. The most notorious of these was La Sombra Negra, the Black Shadow, whose death squads executed people they suspected of gang membership. Honduras and Guatemala started mano dura-style programs of their own, with similar results. Estimates of gang membership today are up to 40,000 in Honduras and 30,000 in El Salvador. Murder rates in all three countries are among the world's highest. A 2010 UN report declared that the mano dura approach was a failure, that it was good at winning votes, but only made the gang problem worse.
There has not been a sense of investment on our youth, but a sense of repression. It's not stopping the problem because they're not hitting the root cause of them.
Alex Sanchez says that mass poverty and the lack of opportunities for young people in El Salvador are the reasons why they get involved with gangs in the first place. While in El Salvador, he saw how joining a gang could make a poor street kid feel important. The attraction was obvious.
To see a 12-year-old kid who's been abused for so long, abandoned and mistreated, to all of a sudden, you know, just put on a tattoo and be empowered and feared, the level these kids were feared was too empowering.
In the mid-90s, Alex decided to return to California. He says he had been targeted by the Sombra Negra death squads and needed to flee. Once back in the States, he made the decision to renounce his gang membership. He began the painful process of getting his tattoos removed and started doing gang intervention work. Now, when he sees the new groups of children from Central America arriving, he's reminded of his own story. Different era, but the same problems.
That's where it all starts. I mean, the fact that they're seeking refuge and they are giving refugees, that is here, does not mean that they're going to be happy and rejoice once they see their families. You know, these kids are going to be troubled. These kids are already at risk. You know, many of these kids are going to go live in poor areas where there's drug addiction, where there's violence, where there's crime, where there's inadequate housing, where there's gangs, you know, and these children could fall prey to any of those things.
It's the same story that Alex lived, a cycle of poverty, violence, migration, alienation, gang life, deportation, rinse and repeat. If nothing is done to intervene on behalf of these children, he says, that same cycle will continue and continue and continue.
Thanks to our producer, Marlon Bishop, for that report. The numbers tell us that gang violence is the single biggest factor in El Salvador driving young people to undertake the risky journey north. But there's a very different reality in Guatemala. Studies show that Guatemalans now are mainly leaving because of suffocating poverty. Luis Argueta is a Guatemalan filmmaker who recently returned from the country. While he was there, he spoke to children who have been deported, and he came to our studio to share with us what he saw and the testimonials he gathered. Luis Argueta, welcome back to Latino USA.
My pleasure to be here, Maria. Muchas gracias por la oportunidad.
So you have recently returned from a two-month-long trip to Guatemala.
Yeah.
So on the ground in Guatemala, you basically, you're a filmmaker, you start talking to people. So give us a sense of, in general, what you were finding.
The first place we went to was a shelter for unaccompanied minors in Quetzaltenango. The one in Quetzaltenango receives the unaccompanied minors who are sent back, deported from Mexico.
And when you're in this shelter for children that have been sent back to Guatemala from Mexico, you meet a young woman named Isias.
Yes, she was 14 years old. I have to tell you, this was the second time she had been deported in 3 weeks.
Yo voy para ayudarles a mis padres.
I'm going to help my parents.
Porque mis padres están aquí y sufren
because
mucho.
My parents are here and they suffer a lot.
Deudas y todo. Tengo mi hermana allá, pero
my sister is in the States, but she has her own kids and she needs to maintain them too.
Isias, she's not Guatemalan?
She is Guatemalan. We started to talk to her in Spanish.
But I notice a kind of Caribbean accent, maybe from Belize.
She was speaking Spanish, and all of a sudden, she said something like, you know, my Spanish is not so good. I said, what? Yeah, I speak English. I live in Belize. And then we started talking in English. And so she's talking about her aunt in Philadelphia.
My aunt helped me a lot. She paid that person, took care of me and all the stuff. Work is waiting for me there. And they were paying me like $100 a day. That's 700 quetzales here. Where will you win that here in a day? That I'm checking. That's why I'm going from here to have a better life. I was babysitter, but it's like, you see, $100 is 700 quetzales, right? And then I went here, 600 a month quetzales. What's that? That's nothing.
So when you asked her, you know, point blank, look, did you know how dangerous this was? And she said, yes. What was your understanding of her notion of the danger?
One of the women who was with me asked her, do you know you could be raped? And her answer was, yes, indeed, the coyote already tried to rape me, but I defended myself. I know how to take care of myself.
Now, Isias is one of the young people who actually didn't make it to the U.S. border. She gets caught and sent back from Mexico. And you asked her about that.
What was the place like?
They do not treat people good like how they treat here, right? You have everything nice, clean, and there is just disgusting. Nothing clean there.
Where did you sleep there?
Well, they give me like a sponge, but the sponge is like the scent of it. It's like lone pee-pee and all those stuff. They do not wash the sheets. They suffer a lot.
You spoke with a father who was waiting for his child after the child had been deported back from Mexico.
Don Julio Cesar, ¿y usted qué está haciendo aquí?
Esperando a una mi hija.
I'm waiting for my daughter.
Que viene deportada de México.
She was deported from Mexico. She's 16 years old.
Tiene 16 años.
This man had come from far away to pick up his daughter. I said, don't you know that it's dangerous? And he said, yes, I do. And I told her that it was dangerous and please not to go. But she insisted and she left. And then I said, what will it take for kids like your daughter not to go? And he said, opportunities.
Ya no hay modos para poder salir adelante. Somos pobres.
There aren't ways for us to come out ahead. We are poor. We don't have money to put our kids through school or job opportunities.
It seems like there might be parents in the United States, parents of teenagers in the United States, who could probably sympathize with parents of teenagers in Central America. You tell your teen, don't do this, and they do what they want.
Teenagers want to see their parents because they've grown without them. So often the parents are not aware.
You've been back from Guatemala less than a week. And already you've been able to make contact with ECS, who we've heard from at the very beginning. This is the young woman who spoke to us in English.
Somehow, I don't know how, I got a Facebook message with a phone number. I added the number that you need to dial long distance, and she answered. And she said, I'm back in Belize. And I said, what did your father say when he picked you up? She said he was very sad that I didn't make it. And I said, you told me you were going to try again. Why haven't you tried? He said, I'm very afraid. Something that I brought back is you know, I think that we as U.S. citizens, we really need to look into our hearts and be a little bit more welcoming and try to get back some of our humanity. I think we've lost sight of what it is to be American, what is to be a human being. And these kids are trying to remind us of that.
Luis Argueta, thank you so much for your on-the-ground reporting while you were in Guatemala.
My pleasure. Gracias, María.
Sin rumbo, la energía negativa, yo la derrumbo.
Coming up on Latino USA, U.S. authorities try to crack down on coyotes.
We've identified and arrested 363 smugglers and their associates, and they've been arrested for criminal charges related to human smuggling.
But can they put a stop to a lucrative smuggling trade? Stay with us. No se vayan.
No, no, no.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. The tens of thousands of Central American children coming to the U.S. don't just show up on their own. Migrant families from Central America rely on teams of human smugglers, sometimes called coyotes or transportistas, in order to get to the United States. Our producer Camilo Vargas tells us how smugglers work through the eyes of Claudia, a young woman from Honduras.
Claudia is 17, a little shy and demure. Her guardian asked us to use her first name only. He says he's concerned for their family's safety back home in a country rife with violence. It took a whole year to plan Claudia's journey to the U.S.
I decided to leave January 10th in 2014.
Her family reached out to a coyote who coordinated a local smuggling group. They scouted him out by word of mouth.
It was from a friend of my grandmother. You get their phone number and you make a contract, how much they'll charge you. And they promise security, but that's not always certain.
Anytime they use a coyote, migrants take a huge risk. Instead of being smuggled into the U.S. to take a job or join family, they might be trafficked into prostitution or forced labor.
So people will go look for good referrals, good information, find a good coyote.
That's Gabriela Sanchez, an anthropologist who researches human smuggling.
The ones that have a good reputation, the ones that are known to take care of children.
Migrants usually see smugglers as service providers who they can trust, but the service isn't cheap. The price for the journey ranges between $5,000 to $12,000 for three tries at crossing the border. And the more you pay, the safer and better you go. As she made her way north, Claudia traveled with different groups of smugglers. The first group got her across Honduras and Guatemala to the border with Mexico.
We waited for Sunday at dawn to cross the Guatemala and Mexico border. We crossed through a fence and walked for a couple of hours.
In Mexico, another group picked up Claudia and crammed her and her fellow travelers in a van. They slept at a rundown ranch in the countryside. The next morning, she was put in a bus on her own to Mexico City.
We traveled 24 hours by bus, afraid we'd be caught, but we had money to pay the Mexican police at the checkpoints. We gave them 200 Mexican pesos.
Claudia's account of paying off Mexican authorities is not uncommon, says Gabriela Sanchez.
Many migrants report having encounters with Mexican law enforcement, having to pay bribes to soldiers, to police officers, to someone who was wearing a uniform.
After 2 days in a coyote-run warehouse in Mexico City, the Mexican smugglers led Claudia to the northeastern town of Reynosa. Out of all the dangers, Claudia feared the Zetas drug cartel the most.
We were really scared of the Zetas, that we'd bump into them and we wouldn't have any money.
She says the Zetas did their drug running during the week when the migrants had to stay out of their way.
You can only cross the river at the border on weekends because they say that's their territory.
Northeastern Mexico, where Claudia was traveling, is dominated by the Zetas and the group they split from, the Gulf Cartel. All along Mexico's smuggling routes, the cartels have carved up their areas of influence. Nothing, including the smugglers, gets past them. Here's Sean McElroy, a special agent with the Department of Homeland Security's investigations.
Basically, there's a fee that has to get paid at these gateways, and there's usually an individual that works for the cartel that collects that fee, and these smuggling organizations have to pay it.
Lately, a few media reports have suggested that members of some drug cartels may be delving into smuggling themselves. Here's Oscar Hagelsieb, another Homeland Security agent, in an August interview with a Texas TV station.
Key operatives of the Gulf Cartel who, before we had only intelligence of them running narcotics, are now, you know, actively involved in human smuggling and human trafficking to the point where they've all but abandoned their drug smuggling activities.
It's difficult to verify how much this is actually happening. But according to McElroy, it's hardly happening at all, and the smugglers operate independently.
There's definitely a connection, but they're not working for the cartels.
What is publicly known is that cartels charge smugglers for passage through their territory and make a hefty profit from the fees.
It's very uncommon for a smuggling organization not to pay
a gateway fee, because there's obvious consequences for that.
The most shocking consequence came in 2010 in the Mexican state of Tamaulipas, where 72 migrants were shot by the Zetas. Migrants and smugglers are targeted for not paying fees and for resisting cartel recruitment. But that's not all that Claudia feared.
We were afraid because they say that in Mexico, gangs kidnap you, rob you, kill you. We were afraid of that.
Based on numbers from Mexico's National Commission on Human Rights, analysts estimate that criminal organizations in Mexico kidnap up to 20,000 migrants per year. Migrant children also risk being abandoned. In March of this year, Reuters reported that more than 300 migrant children had been found wandering through Mexico after the smugglers charged their fees and left them on the road. And sometimes, says Sanchez the anthropologist, unreliable smugglers sell the migrants off.
People are more likely to be at risk when they hire the services of a smuggler they do not know. And again, this usually happens to those who have very weak networks, very limited financial resources, or no or limited awareness of the conditions along the border.
Claudia was lucky. Her coyotes delivered her safely to the Texas border near the city of McAllen. She says they sent children to guide the migrants across the river at the border. When they made it to the U.S. side, another group of smugglers was supposed to take over, but that never happened.
We were crouched and hiding when suddenly immigration comes and surrounds us, saying, "Hurry up, get out of here, we see you."
The Border Patrol apprehended Claudia along with 15 other migrants. She was taken to a nearby detention center. She remembers some kids turned themselves in voluntarily.
Some kids just gave themselves up to immigration because they'd been told that since they were children, they could go through and they wouldn't be deported.
Coyotes have reportedly spread rumors about an immigration amnesty in the U.S. What is clear is that smugglers know the immigration system and that many migrants know that children from Central America are not immediately deported, thanks to a 2008 anti-trafficking law. Still, at the same time, U.S. law enforcement is working with Central American governments to crack down on smugglers.
Since June 23rd through August 18th of this year, we've identified and arrested 363 smugglers and their associates, and they've been arrested for criminal charges related to human smuggling.
That's Homeland Security Agent Sean McElroy describing Operation Coyote.
We've seized 39 vehicles, approximately $839,000 in illicit profits from human smuggling organizations.
Reporters covering the issue in Central America and Mexico describe an environment of fear among coyotes in Central America as the U.S. makes high-profile busts. The migration of minors to the U.S. border has also slowed down dramatically in the last 2 months. The scorching desert heat at the border, the public awareness campaigns in Central America, and the smuggling crackdown might all be driving down the flow. After a few days in detention, Claudia was handed over to U.S. Health and Human Services. She spent a few weeks at a shelter in Texas before being shipped on a plane to meet her family in New York, including the brother she hadn't seen in years.
Wow, no lo podía creer y...
Wow, I couldn't believe it. I cried. It was such a great joy to see him again. I was too young when he left and didn't remember him.
Claudia's immigration case is awaiting a court date. And because there's a backlog of cases like hers, it could be years before her case is heard. Until then, she's safe with family.
That was Latino USA producer Camilo Vargas. Okay, mis queridos, we now take our story from the border to the newsroom. In early June, when this child refugee supposed crisis story landed onto the front page of every newspaper and media site, we here at Latino USA were a bit surprised because we've known for years that unaccompanied children and Central Americans have been crossing the border in large numbers. So why all of a sudden was this deemed a crisis?
But we begin tonight with stunning breaking news as a major crisis.
A crisis of tens of thousands.
A crisis.
The immediate crisis of the kids.
It may come down to one thing. Those photos. June 5th, Brandon Darby, a reporter for Breitbart, Texas, published an article that featured pictures of detention centers that revealed conditions that are, quite frankly, unbelievable. The photograph showed rooms filled to their capacity, children that look as young as five laying on top of each other on the ground. It's hard not to be affected by the pictures.
The federal government was making it impossible for the press to get access to the children in the detention centers. Somehow, Breitbart Media got access.
This is Aviva Chomsky. She's a professor of history at Salem State University in Massachusetts and has been following the media's handling of this story closely.
So Breitbart got hold of these photos and distributed them with a very clear political message.
Nearly 160,000 immigrants have been picked up in the last 8 months. Making matters worse, a lot of folks are from places like Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, where it's not so easy to just boot them back over the border.
Breitbart is a conservative news and opinion site. These photos were presented as proof of the Obama administration's failure. As these pictures began to make their way across the internet and more people discovered the horrible conditions these children were detained in, an entirely different narrative began to arise.
Recently, the Obama administration has called the surge of unaccompanied minors crossing the U.S.-Mexico border alarming, even going as far as saying that the situation is a, quote, urgent humanitarian issue.
The unaccompanied child migrant story became a humanitarian crisis.
The crisis was what was happening to the children once they were at the border.
But the crisis wasn't about where the children were coming from or why they were coming. It was about the detention centers. And that allowed some politicians to play the humanitarian hero card. Take Massachusetts, where Professor Chomsky lives.
Governor Deval Patrick, very much along the lines of taking this as a humanitarian crisis with no historical context, said, oh, well, we should take some of those children in Massachusetts.
My faith teaches that if a stranger dwells with you in your land, you shall not mistreat him.
He cried publicly when he was saying this.
But rather love him as yourself.
All of the immigrant rights organizations were sort of circling around Patrick and how wonderful it was that in Massachusetts we're welcoming him, we want to take in some of these children. What Patrick was actually offering was to temporarily detain these children in Massachusetts. It was a very cheap kind of humanitarianism. It was going to be completely paid for by the federal government.
Lynn has now become, in many ways, ground zero for the immigration crisis engulfing this country.
Lynn, which is a city about 15 miles north of Boston, it's a deindustrialized city. It's a struggling city.
And we just don't have space anymore. Well, our own children need our help, too.
The mayor of the city of Lynn really jumped into the fray and I think has gotten kind of a national profile now, framing it that these Central American children are taking resources that we need for our poor children, for the poor children who are citizens. The Republicans are saying, look at those bleeding heart Democrats that are ignoring white working people. And the Democrats were saying, look at those cruel Republicans who have no hearts.
The theatrics in Massachusetts were just one example of the political posturing that happened all across the country. A Republican congressional candidate from Arizona even confused a bus of YMCA campers for a bus of child migrants when trying to show off in front of cameras.
Actually see some of the children in the buses and the fear on their faces. This is not compassion.
Do you know that was a bus with YMCA kids?
They were sad too.
3 months since the Breitbart photos leaked, this story has all but disappeared from the news cycle. So does that mean the crisis has been solved? The number of children crossing into the United States has dropped from over 10,000 in June to roughly 3,000 in August. We don't know for sure why that is, but a possible explanation is the August heat, which makes crossing the desert more dangerous. The Department of Homeland Security is taking credit, though, saying it's due to their stepped-up enforcement in the U.S. and increased cooperation with Central American and Mexican governments.
Another piece of the response of the Obama administration that, again, I feel like the media is not reporting this because they're not seeing the crisis in all of its dimensions, has been to exert extreme pressure on Mexico to prevent Central American children from reaching the border at all. So there's been a huge increase in militarization, detention, and deportation happening in Mexico.
It all comes down to how we define crisis.
If the crisis is only the fact that the children are in detention centers in the United States, attacking, detaining, raiding, and deporting them in Mexico solves the crisis. But if the crisis is what's happening to these children, simply preventing them from arriving in the United States just makes them invisible to us. It doesn't address the crisis that they're undergoing.
It was 30 years ago that I was putting the finishing touches on my undergraduate thesis. So, what was I writing about? The human drama of Central American women from El Salvador who were refugees in Long Island, New York. Thousands of them. That was 30 years ago, people. How can we suddenly, 30 years later, have a media and a society and a government that basically says, "Oh my God! Refugees from Central America! Where did that come from? And they're bringing a crisis to our doorstep!" Since then, our country has hit another low point, calling these children invaders, a horde, and a surge. They're not insects or soldiers, people. Central America is part of us. Our worlds are so linked, it's like steel rods running up and down from Postville, Iowa, to Panama. And American soldiers have been on those lands for more than 100 years. U.S. interventions in wars created refugees, some of who were given status here but then deported, whose children or grandchildren then came back to El Norte in search of family or safety. These are not aliens who just decided to come north to some strange land. They know this land because the USA has been there, done that in their countries. No, the ties that bind us run deep, and although the headlines are gone and the media has moved on, we know these migrants will keep coming. The policies of this country have deep and far-reaching impact. So, no, it's not a surprise that we have child refugees now from Iraq and Somalia. The ties that bind us to them might be more recent, but these are the ties of a small world where children don't see borders in the U.S., but only hope. And I thought we were the kind of country that used to give it. And for this week, mis queridos, that's our show. Latino USA was produced by Marlon Bishop, AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our intern is Julia Hsu. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
I'd like to apologize in advance if I say anything kind of inappropriate or...
Well, I'll let you know if it'll cost you your life or not.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.